And coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz, sorry for the volume displacement there, you are tuned to 101.1 FM, freakradio.org, and the next show is Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. Special interview with jailbird Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs, and then live phone interview with Ben Matheson of Orlando Food Not Bombs in about 15 minutes. So stay tuned. And I'm Robert Norris. This is a two-hour show that I do every Thursday, and a longer version of it happens on Sunday. Today we're going to do a little catching up. I'd interview with Keith McHenry, who co-founded the organization Food Not Bombs, oh gosh, 30 years ago, 32 or 3 years ago, along with other folks. And he's been in Orlando, Florida, struggling to make food sharing legal. Over than 20 people have been arrested. And he was arrested yesterday, and we're going to get a report on that arrest. But before he was arrested, three or four days before he was arrested, actually, I think more than that, I think it was last week, we had an interview with him on the phone, and here it is. I'm going to play it for you now, and then we'll get updated from Ben of Orlando Food Not Bombs in about 15 minutes. So stay tuned and listen in. It's a very important issue. It's the attempt to criminalize free food serving with a political message, which is, of course, the essence of Food Not Bombs. And it happened in Santa Cruz 20 years ago. We fought back, were jailed repeatedly, and then finally the authorities gave up and stopped harassing Food Not Bombs. So there is not currently, as far as I know, an active Food Not Bombs in Santa Cruz. But let's consider what's happening in Orlando. There may be a demonstration in solidarity throughout the country at city halls all over the nation, including the Santa Cruz City Hall, on June 30th and July 1st to support Orlando Food Not Bombs. We'll see if that comes off. We'll be looking to prepare that, we being HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and perhaps some other groups. So stay tuned if you'd like to talk more about that or hear more about that issue. And here is Keith McHenry in a phone interview coming up. Today is June 16th, 2011. It's around 3:20, although I guess it's about 6:20 in Florida. I'm talking on the phone with activist Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs. Hi, Keith.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, good. So what's cooking? I understand you're in Orlando, and this is, I guess, day of arrest number 4 that just happened yesterday?
Yeah, we've had 21 people arrested. There were 6 more yesterday.
And as of today, Thursday, June 23rd, there were 2 more arrested on Wednesday, and none on, actually 3 more arrested if you count Keith, and none on last Monday. They serve every Monday and Wednesday in Orlando at Lake Eola Park.
Dinner. And this keeps happening. We also had another crazy thing happen yesterday where the city, turned out the original trespass order allowed you to be in the park for First Amendment activities. And so there was a number they gave us to call, which we've been calling, and they were not trespassing us. But they got upset about that and changed the rules and then gave us a new trespass order yesterday. And so our attorney is now taking them to court over that. That was the newest thing that happened today. And the problem is that all 21 people now are not even able to go and touch the tables and move things around for the meal. And I think we will overcome that. We will just probably start to share the meal over on the street or something like that. And then they'll have to come up with a new... Then they won't even be able to bother us at all because theoretically we're not in the park. And that will be an interesting thing. But we haven't gotten to that point yet. That's something we've been talking about. So
you have the 6 people who have been arrested, have they left jail? Did they have to bail out? Were they OR'd? That was yesterday.
Yeah, some have been OR'd. We finally have gotten to the point where we have local people being OR'd, so that's great. We did have a number of people from St. Petersburg Food Not Bombs that were arrested, so they couldn't be OR'd. They were bailed. And one of the, but there's also a thing that the mayor, Buddy Dyer, is trying to put out, which is that, we're just going to leave when the media stops showing. But there was no media yesterday at all at the meal. except for, I mean, there was one reporter from the Orlando Weekly, but there was no TV, no radio, no nothing like that. And so, of course, there was even more people than normal there, and more cops than normal, more police cars than normal, and then, of course, more arrests than we've had before, 6 arrests. The 5 was the largest before that.
And Keith is talking about the meal that happened a week and a day ago at Orlando, Florida. And we'll be hearing more about the meal that happened yesterday when Ben calls in. Keith, as I said, is in jail. And people who want to listen into this, of course, can do so. And people who want to call in will be able to call in on an alternate number, which I'm going to give out. I think the number that people can call in on is 831-427-3772. We will be hearing from Ben shortly.
And so then so we had 3 people from St. Petersburg Food Not Bombs get arrested. And we had 2 people from Orlando Food Not Bombs that have housing, renting housing. And then 1 person that lives on the street but has been very active with Food Not Bombs. And that also flies in the face of the city's comments that it's, that we have no support amongst the homeless. And we've actually had a number of people living on the street that have been helping us, and this was the first one of them. I mean, a lot of them have been risking arrest, but this is the first time an actual person living on the streets of Orlando has been arrested. So,
what kind of food is Orlando Food Not Bombs serving?
Well, it's basically gourmet, organic, vegan food. It's amazing. Some of the cooks are professional vegan cooks. Jessica, who was one of the first people arrested, along with myself, and Ben, she is cooks at a vegan restaurant at Disney World, and she works as a baker, vegan baker. So the food is really quite amazing, and it's a huge amount of it. It's really, you could probably, some people come twice through the line, and it's pretty amazing. So the food is quite tasty always. It's some of the highest quality food I've seen.
Now you feed at least 26 people or 25, and then the 26th person they can arrest the chefs because you don't have a permit for feeding in Lake Eola Park, right?
Right. Yeah. The 25th person is the crime, and then after that, And they do write down, of course, at the beginning of the month, that they wrote that we shared to 40 people. It keeps getting more and more, of course, as the month moves along. And, the height of the number of people that I've seen, there's been way over 100 eating, and that was towards the end of the month, last month, in May. So this is for quite the situation here. We're also still getting support from around the world. More and more people are doing actions in other cities. Some of the original news stories from June 2nd about the June 1st arrest are still circulating and on the Facebook and so on, and people are contacting us, hearing about the story for the first time. So we're trying to build support. We did get one of the aspects of support is to get organizations, as an organization, to write a letter to the mayor and also give us a copy stating their support for Food Not Bombs and for our right to share food and to organize politically in Lake Eola Park. Then we got the first group to do that was called the October 2011 Coalition, which is a very large coalition of Peace and Social Justice groups, and they posted it on their website and sent it to the mayor. This is really quite positive. And then we also had a number of songs written about Food Not Bombs. The Ballad of Lake Eola by David Rovick was just put on YouTube. That's quite impressive. There's been, there was the food sharing in Detroit. There's been a petition drive set up by different people around the world. And so we're very much eager to get support in the Santa Cruz area. And what people are starting to do is we had a gathering of Food Not Bombs actors from Florida, and we came together and decided on the first of each month we would have a tent city vigil. I know you guys have been having a hard time with that in Santa Cruz, but we are starting to get a lot of support for that, and we've gotten a number of cities or have confirmed that they are doing this action in solidarity with ending the criminalization of poverty, and under the banner human needs, not corporate greed. And this is something that we're really encouraging. And if people can take pictures, talk to local media, and include the issue of the arrest of Orlando Fidel Bombs in their effort, we will put it on the web, and we want to make sure it gets to the mayor to show that all over the world there are actions on July 1st in solidarity with Orlando Fidel Bombs.
And so how many cities so far have responded positively with planned actions?
Well, we have Fort Lauderdale, Sarasota, Tampa just announced. We have Houston, Texas, Miami, of course, Orlando, St. Petersburg. We've been talking to people in Boston. San Francisco has been talking about it, so we're hoping that this starts to take off. And, we're really excited about it. If Santa Cruz can add their name to this, that would be so cool.
Well, I know that, I guess a year or two ago when we talked about ways to fight back against the Obama-Bush wars, you were recommending a similar monthly camp out at post offices throughout the country to kind of in Tunisian style, though Tunisia had not yet exploded, have the people generally come up and say, we're going to stay here until these wars end, something that seems to be getting a little bit of play in the House of Representatives recently.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating. I mean, several years ago, a friend of mine who died of brain cancer about 4 years ago, Valentine, she had put out she had talked to me a lot about an idea of recreating the tent city protest that had happened in San Francisco in 1989, how effective that was. So I'd actually put up a website with photos of 10 cities that Fidel Bombs was connected to and helped provide food of, with photos of them. So there was a two-year tent city protest in Bosnia-Herzegovina Park in Sarajevo that Fidel Bombs provided the food. That was a protest for farmers' rights in Sarajevo after the U.S. bombardment and essentially the creation of so-called free trade zones in the former Yugoslavia, which really hurt agriculture. And then also the 100-day Orange Revolution in the Ukraine. Fidel Bombs was quite active in providing the food for that. That was a tent city of orange tents that were put up throughout the in front of the Parliament building there. And so there's been this kind of idea of that, promoting that. And then, of course, when the people in Tunisia and Egypt and Yemen and other places have started the same idea. This idea seems to be like coming to people's imagination all over the world. Then you saw tent city protests all over Spain several weeks ago, which are continuing, and you've got the same thing is happening in Athens, all throughout France. Essentially, there's a global anti-austerity movement that is happening where people are pushing back. Even in China, there's a thing called the stroll-in, which people on Sundays all over China all go to the main public square, like Tiananmen Square and so on, and stroll in. And so there's all this creativity around nonviolent direct action seeking democratic changes and changes against the idea that we should get rid of all of our social services and education and medical care and all that and hand over the commonwealth to the wealthiest individuals in our communities. So people are fighting back everywhere. I mean, it's quite impressive. And this may be, you've got a Walkerville in Madison, Wisconsin happening right now because of the same issues. And so hopefully the July 1st will be a way for cities all across the country to start addressing this, you know, having a statement against what is happening with the horrible loss cuts and failure of the economy.
I know in Wisconsin, I guess I was reading yesterday in Democracy Now!'s online transcript that the courts have thrown out the, well, they've upheld the legislature's anti-union legislation that they that people fought with the Tent City, and the legislature fought by walking out, and then they fought in the courts. Now they're trying to do some kind of a recall, but I guess I haven't seen any kind of restoration of the Tent City actions of the spring that were happening in Madison. Have you seen any arrivals of any kind of tent cities in the U.S. that might indicate, you know, that this movement is spreading or is starting again?
Well, the Walkerville started in Madison a week ago and soon up on to sharing food at that action in Madison. And so the tent city has sprung up again outside the Capitol building there.
How big is
it? I don't know how big it is. I think it's several thousand people. And then on the weekends, they have the big giant marches and stuff of tens of thousands. So that actually has been, you know, it's interesting because the news of that has been suppressed, but I think it's much larger. You know, it's a pretty large action as far as tent city protests in America go. So I've been getting word from people there, you know, that about what's happening. The Food Not Bombs kids have been also being medics at the protest, and so that's like ongoing. And the Tent City Action Hopeville and Food Not Bombs in St. Louis is feeding Hopeville on the banks of the Mississippi. That's ongoing. There's a huge political crisis with the city government there. Apparently, there's like been like police invasions, but then. Sustained itself anyway. So there are, you know, this is starting to take off, I think, in a lot of venues. Then there was that interesting, it's not Tent City protest, but there was a page in the Parliament of Canada that just held a sign that said, Stop Harris. And then she was 21 years old, she went out. Her speech in front of the Parliament building on being escorted out of the building was was very strong. It was in solidarity with all efforts to fight back against these austerity measures.
And we're going to hold up on that because on the line with us we have one of the organizers and jailbirds from Orlando, Florida, Ben Markison. Hey, Ben.
Hi, Robert. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm not in jail, unlike certain people. I guess you're not in jail, but...
No, thankfully.
But Keith McHenry is in jail tonight, right?
Unfortunately, Keith is. Keith was arrested yesterday at Lake Eola Park in downtown Orlando for trespassing, and his bond was revoked this morning by the judge he went in front of. So unless he can get a bond hearing, he'll be in jail until at least July 5th, which is when he has his first appearance for his food-sharing arrest.
Now, were you a witness to the arrest?
No, I wasn't. I was on my way to the park, and I was called by someone who did see his arrest.
And what kind of a description did you get about what went down there?
Well, Keith was in the process of trying to set up a literature table so he could hand out flyers about Food Not Bombs and related issues like poverty and hunger in our society. And apparently, in the process of setting up the table, he strayed a couple inches over the line into the park from the sidewalk around the park, and there was a plainclothes police officer who was there ready to videotape us as he does every week since this started, and when he saw Keith, he immediately called some uniformed officers who came over and arrested Keith. I think they were gunning for Keith, basically.
And so, what is it? He's charged with trespass in a public park?
Trespass after warning in a public park, which carries up to a one-year jail sentence. In Florida.
So it's kind of hard. I mean, I know we have some similar laws here, although they're infractions initially. Again, there's a state code against trespass, and indeed there's a hearing tomorrow for Ed Fry, and I'm not sure, possibly for Gary Johnson, though. That's not clear to me. Two activists being held in jail for sleep ban protests on the steps of the county building last fall. They were convicted in a jury trial, and they got the 6-month sentence. But
You know, and there, and it's also illegal. We were thinking of doing this protest in front of City Hall on July 1st and June 30th that Keith has suggested be done all over the country.
Right.
But, I
and
mean, we have a law against
Orlando.
Our City Hall grounds, unlike most City Hall grounds, simply, specifically in order to stop the protest of last year, has been now posted with signs you're not allowed to be there after 10 o'clock at night. So that may involve some of us, if we choose to go there, to be arrested for trespass as well.
So much for City Hall belonging to the people, huh?
You got it. But then again, the people have to reclaim City Hall. It hasn't belonged to the people for a long time, I think.
Very true. Very true indeed.
But, I mean, I need to understand this. So if you – there have been, I guess, what, 24, 25 people now arrested for
– 23 people have been arrested under Orlando's anti-food sharing ordinance, and Keith was arrested under that ordinance, and then he was arrested yesterday for trespassing.
Yeah,
that's a total of 24 arrests, and each person who's been arrested under the food sharing ordinance has been trespassed for a year from Lake Eola Park.
Which means that they've been told they can't go back to Lake Eola Park, which is the park where you're serving food every Monday and Wednesday evening, or Monday morning
right,
and Wednesday?
And we do breakfast on Monday mornings and dinner on Wednesday evening.
And so the Wednesday meal then has to be done by people who have not previously done the food serving, or else they'll be
right.
arrested for trespass.
And I am pleased to report that we have plenty of volunteers in our local community who are willing to step forward and risk arrest to share food with poor and hungry people in our community.
And what about the turnout of people who are actually seeking to get food? We're talking, I guess it's getting now towards the middle end of the month again, which in California and in Santa Cruz means the lines get longer and the people get hungrier and the wallets get much thinner. What's happening in Orlando around that?
Well, the numbers are still good. I know that the Orlando police are trying to intimidate the people with whom we share by telling them that we're not sharing anymore, or telling them that if they come into the park to get food, they might get arrested. But so far, they haven't been deterred, and our numbers are still good and are holding steady, because the people with whom we share need the food, and they also know that they're not welcome in downtown Orlando, and by continuing to show up at our food sharings, it's their way of pushing back against the city.
And your food sharing in Lake Eola is in downtown Orlando?
Right, it's at the corner of Osceola and Central.
So ironically, even though people are risking arrest, I don't know. Is it a zone where people feel more comfortable being, or have the police made it a really uncomfortable zone?
Well, I think you have to look at the anti-food sharing ordinance in the broader context. It's one of several measures that the administration of Mayor John H. Dyer has instituted to try to make poor and homeless people feel unwelcome in downtown Orlando. They also have ordinances against sitting on the sidewalk, sleeping on the sidewalk, sleeping in the public park, and they also have an anti-panhandling ordinance, and they even have a six-person undercover Orlando Police Department squad that goes out and tries to arrest people for panhandling.
Now, we're talking about peaceful panhandling? Are we talking, Santa Cruz has an ordinance that talks about aggressive panhandling, but of course,
right.
That isn't really what it criminalizes. It criminalizes virtually all panhandling that isn't done within very, very limited panhandling areas and only at limited times. It's a way of trying to stop the courts from striking down these laws as First Amendment violations,
right,
but still
exactly.
Clearing away the public sidewalks of people who are panhandling.
Orlando may be one of the only cities in the country that actually has what it calls panhandling zones, which are blue boxes painted on the sidewalk in like 36 locations in downtown Orlando. Most of them not high traffic locations, of course. That's deliberate. And panhandling is limited to those. However, last year the city passed an ordinance that bans panhandling between 7 p.m. and 7 a.m.
Interesting.
Which
yeah,
we find time in downtown Orlando because of the traffic.
And what's the penalty for violating these ordinances?
60 days in jail and a $250 fine.
And how many people have been charged under them, as far as you know?
That I don't know, but I'm guessing that it's probably a lot of people, because I know that the police are very aggressive about enforcing this ordinance, because, as I said, it's one of a range of ordinances that the administration of Mayor John Dyer has instituted to try to make poor and hungry and homeless people feel unwelcome in downtown Orlando. But the issue that really concerns me and other members of Orlando Food Not Bombs right now is the fact that not only has the Mayor Dyer has gone beyond just the food sharing ordinance, and now he's trying to infringe on our First Amendment rights to hold protest signs and to dissent from his policies. Last Monday, he sent out a city code enforcement officer to try to claim that we needed a permit just to stand on a street corner and hold a cardboard sign, hold a piece of poster.
Well, that has a very traditional basis. I think in Birmingham, Alabama, in 1963, Sheriff Jim Clark did exactly the same thing, get them niggers off the streets.
Yeah, well, and Mayor Dyer could be Sheriff Clark then, because that's his attitude. He does not want any poor and hungry people in downtown Orlando because they think they're bad for business. It's a classic case of profits before people.
Now, are you the police have their undercover video people who snagged and bagged Keith yesterday for being
only. They're not so undercover. They're very open about what they're doing.
Are you videoing as well to get counter evidence?
Yeah, we have had dozens of people who have come out and videotaped and taken photographs of the food sharings and of the arrests. And we have several people who have come out every food sharing to videotape. As a matter of fact, if you want to see some YouTube videos of the arrests and related interviews with Keith and other people about the food sharings, go to YouTube and look through the channel that's called 4D Productions.
4D as in David?
Right, Productions. And there's more than a dozen videos about the food sharings and interviews with Keith and related issues that a local documentary filmmaker named T.J. McCarthy has posted.
Did anybody video Keith's arrest?
There's no video of Keith's arrest because it happened before the food sharing actually had started, because Keith got there early, as I said, to set up his literature table. He was doing that to exercise his First Amendment rights.
And he was doing that on the sidewalk. I know that you originally found a loophole in this trespass law that allowed you to go into the park and, you know, provided you informed them first that you were there for First Amendment activities, even though you'd been told when you were arrested and bonded out that you couldn't go back to the park to do feeding. You could go back there for First Amendment activities. And then how did they close that loophole?
Well, they had the police and park rangers find everyone they could find who was protesting at our food sharing, standing on the public sidewalk with signs, or just standing there videotaping or just observing. And they found the people who had been arrested, and what they did was they handed them revised trespass warnings that don't have the First Amendment exemption in them.
Well, in other words, just because the police decided to edit out the First Amendment exemption, that means people are suddenly deciding they don't have First Amendment rights?
Right, and I don't think it was the police who decided that. I think it was Mayor Dyer who decided that.
Well, even if it was Mayor Dyer who decided that, I mean, who is he to make decisions about the First Amendment? I guess you don't have lawyers who are ready to rush into court to get an injunction against that.
No, actually, we do have a very good local lawyer, Cheyenne Alahi, and he is actually pursuing our legal options to address the First Amendment issues and also to address other legal issues related to our arrest, and he will have some announcements tomorrow about legal actions that we're undertaking to address these issues.
So as I understand it, we have at least two issues here. One of them is well, there are all kinds of basic issues that are being, you know, trampled on, the constitutionally speaking. But, I mean, you have an ordinance which is, you know, trying to pay a passing respect to the First Amendment by saying, well, if you're in the park, even if they tell you not to be there for, you know, for other reasons, maybe you, you know, messed up the grass or violated the food ordinance, nonetheless, you can go back to do First Amendment activity. Now, suddenly, they, through an administrative revision, which doesn't sound like it's legislatively correct anyway. You can't administratively revise an ordinance Yeah, at least in many cases you can, although admittedly in Santa Cruz they grant broad powers to the heads of Parks and Rec to suddenly set hours anywhere in the city on any Parks and Rec property that they control or administer, which is a lot of property. It includes up and down all Pacific Avenue. I mention this not for your benefit, Ben, but for other people listening who are here in Santa Cruz. The entire Poganip area, every park in the city, and lots of other areas, including City Hall and the library. So they apparently can just independently, without, you know, getting any kind of law passed or discussion of why the First Amendment and public access to property needs to be cut off, just do that. That's going to make it difficult for us to do this protest if we do it on June 30th and July 1st in solidarity with Orlando Food Not Bombs and with people fighting austerity measures throughout the country and throughout the world, which is really the broader issue. But you have, you know, in Orlando, it looks like you have two things going here, you know, which your lawyer is maybe fighting, which is one is the sudden, you know, removal of the First Amendment protection clause, as well as the idea that somebody setting up a table 2 inches into the park is some sort of intentional trespass. Trespass requires intent, does it not? Are they're claiming Keith intended to do that?
I believe it should. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't, you know, I can't really address that. But I think the fact that they arrested him for what essentially was his accidentally going into the park for a few seconds while he was trying to set up a table, I think speaks volumes about what their real agenda is, which is they're not only trying to shut down the food sharing, now they've gone beyond that and they're attacking the First Amendment. They're attacking free speech. Because our standing out there holding protest signs, Keith handing out literature, that's the cornerstone of all our other rights and civil liberties, is our ability to express ourselves and dissent from our government.
Indeed. I know in San Francisco, which is reputedly a liberal city, and the Board of Supervisors does pass liberal measures, even in some cases supporting San Francisco Food Not Bombs when it was under attack a decade and a half ago, Keith McHenry was hospitalized half a dozen times, assaulted twice as many times as that by the San Francisco police. Do you have any indication of how the Orlando police are treating him?
Well, I do have to say, in all fairness, that the Orlando police have not mistreated or manhandled anyone. And if I may be so bold as to say this, my impression is that the Orlando police, we feel like they're being used to implement Mayor Dyer's agenda. And I think that a lot of them probably feel they have better things to do then arrest people who are trying to share vegan food in the public park with hungry people.
They have real criminals to address. That's a nice line, Ben, but why would they then go out of their way to get Keith McHenry if he wasn't even sharing food, if he was abiding by this absurd and abusive restriction about not being able to use the public park, even if he's not, quote, criminally sharing food?
This was Mayor Dyer's answer to Keith, because Keith sent Mayor Dyer a letter on June 13th asking if he would meet with Orlando Food Not Bombs so that we could start having dialogue around these issues and see if we couldn't find a way to resolve these issues. And he didn't respond formally to this letter. However, I think that Keith's arrest is Mayor Dyer's response to Keith's letter. I think it's pretty clear that right now Mayor Dyer is not interested in talking to anyone about this issue or dialoguing with citizens or negotiating or finding a reasonable solution. Mayor Dyer just wants people to be arrested because his agenda isn't about keeping the parks clean and safe, because our food sharing has only lasted a total of 4 hours a week. Don't cause any problems in the park. We clean up after ourselves. We share food with people who are there anyway, because many of the people we share with do live in downtown Orlando. Many of them are working people who simply don't earn enough, and at the end of the month, they don't have any money left, but they're still hungry. And so they come to us to get food, because the food that we offer is healthy, nutritious, vegan food that's tasty. Frankly, a lot of the food available at the local homeless shelters is not very good from what I've heard. You know, it's like bologna sandwiches and day-old bread. It's not, you know, it's not healthy, nutritious food made with love and concern for the people who are eating it.
Any word from Keith in jail? Have you spoken to him, or has anybody else spoken to him?
Yeah, I have spoken to Keith a couple times. Keith's spirits are good. He's on a hunger fast until he's released from the jail. And he has a Facebook page, and I've been posting updates there, and I'm going to post another update that will have the jail address where people can send him letters of support. And also there will be another link up there that will explain to people how to put money in Keith's telephone account so that he can make telephone calls.
You want to? This is on again. How can people get this information?
This will be on Keith's Facebook page. If you just simply go to Facebook and search for Keith McHenry, it'll come up, and I'll post that probably later tonight or tomorrow morning.
So Keith did give you an account of his arrest, and he reported no abusive treatment by police.
No, Keith. No, he hasn't been abused or physically hurt in any way by the police.
And he's now been held for about a day in jail.
Right.
And he expects to be held for another 2 weeks until July 5th?
Right. That's when he has his first appearance in the food-sharing arrest.
Do I understand there's no bail for him now at all?
The judge revoked his bail from the food-sharing, his bond from the food-sharing arrest because of the trespassing arrest. However, our lawyer is going to file for another bond hearing as soon as he can.
And that's likely to happen in the next few days or after July 5th?
It should happen in the early part of next week. Right now we're dealing with some other legal issues, and I can tell you actually that one of the legal issues is we're going to be filing for an injunction tomorrow morning around the arrest, because our lawyer discovered that there's an administrative order from the chief judge to the local judicial circuit that said that that municipalities shouldn't arrest people for violating city ordinances. They should write them citations. And apparently the city of Orlando may not have been following this administrative order.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the issues we're going to attempt to address with the request for injunctive relief.
And what's the turnaround time on that kind of relief, do you know?
I don't know. It's really up to the court.
I mean, I'm sure there's probably, and if they're looking for injunctive relief, that's immediate relief.
Right. It's up to the court. They can go ahead and issue an injunction and schedule a hearing, or they can schedule a hearing without issuing an injunction, and then after the hearing, they can make a decision about whether or not it should be granted.
How many people did you feed today? Yesterday for dinner?
I would estimate that we shared. Probably, it's hard to say because I'm not able to go into the park since I'm trespassed, so it's very hard for me to do a count. But I would estimate that, well, we certainly shared with over 25 people because we had two members of Orlando Food Not Bombs, Ellison Estes and Doug Coleman, who were arrested under the ordinance. So since the police wait to count how many times a person ladles food out before they arrest them for violating the ordinance, it's very clear that they each ladled food out to at least 25 people before they were arrested, probably more.
So in theory, you could have somebody ladle food to 24 people, then have somebody else come up and ladle food to 24 people, then somebody else come and nobody would be arrested or violating the law anyway, at least in theory?
In theory, the city seems to have varying interpretations of the ordinance, just like they seem to have varying interpretations of what the First Amendment means. That's the problem with the city of Orlando is they keep changing. It appears that the police don't even know what the boundaries of the park are, because we've asked them and we've gotten different answers. That's the problem with the city of Orlando is it speaks out of both sides of its mouth, which is why we're going to have to go to court.
In Santa Cruz there and in California, there is concern about overcrowding in the jails and the amount of money being spent on jails and a really a serious budget crunch. Is that the case as well in Florida?
Yes, it is. A lot of municipalities and a lot of counties in Florida have had to cut their budgets because of the recession, because of cutbacks in funding. The only thing that staved off some of the more draconian cuts was the stimulus money, and that's run out. And of course, in Florida, we have a terrible governor, Rick Scott, who's a ultra right wing Republican, and he slashed like $4 billion out of our state budget. Basically, he tried to balance the state budget on the backs of poor people and elderly people and children.
Is there much reaction in the sense of, you know, like Middle Eastern type reaction, people standing up in great numbers, Wisconsin type reaction to the austerity measures and the attacks on the poor in Florida and specifically in Orlando?
Yeah, there's been a lot of pushback in Orlando and across the state because I think people realize that these aren't just budget cuts. These aren't just abstract political issues. These are real actions by real politicians that affect the lives of real people, including people who can't afford to have anything else taken away from them, people who are struggling to survive in an economy where there's still high unemployment and where there's not a lot of living wage jobs. Orlando has a plethora of service jobs that don't really pay a living wage, but we don't have a lot of living wage jobs here, that, you know, jobs that pay people enough to be able to afford housing and health care and just to be able to live, you know, with a decent standard of living and with some dignity.
Orlando is a city of how many people?
220,000 in the city limits, about 1.5 million in the metropolitan area.
Hmm. And what's the racial mix in Orlando?
Orlando is probably about 40% African American.
And how about Latino?
That I'm not sure, but we do have a substantial Latino population in Central Florida, particularly Puerto Ricans because of our proximity to Puerto Rico.
How about Cuban?
Yes, we do have a sizable Cuban American population, not as large as South Florida, of course. But we do have a Cuban American community.
Now, where is Orlando in Florida? I know it's kind of a strange shaped state. You know, I mean, it's got this weird, you know, extension off to the west, and then it zooms down to the south. And
well, Orlando is in what's called Central Florida, and Orlando is about 70 miles from Tampa. Orlando is a landlocked city, but you can get to the Tampa Bay area in about an hour. You can get to the beaches like in Daytona in about an hour.
Right. I mean, I don't even know where Tampa is for that, right? Or Miami, even. I've got no idea what's what in Florida. But I know there, it's well-populated state, a lot of people there. I know here in Santa Cruz there's been a lot of controversy about the ESCOM so-called secure communities issue, where immigrants without proper papers are being picked up on trivial offenses and then turned over to the ICE. Is that happening in Florida as well?
Yeah, there's been problems in Central Florida with, like, the local sheriff's office in Lake County, which is a county adjacent to Orange County, where Orlando is located, and they've been racially profiling immigrants. And I know that there's some lawsuits that have happened because of that. I don't know all the details, but there have been problems in Lake County with racial profiling of Hispanic, or people who are perceived as being Hispanic immigrants.
I mean, I've been concerned in Santa Cruz about possible arrest and harassment of poor people who are undocumented for violating the city's downtown ordinances, a criminalized sitting on the sidewalk, peacefully asking for spare change, sitting at a political table too close to a building, sitting on a bench for more than 60 minutes, which is illegal in Santa Cruz.
Wow.
Being at City Hall after dark, being on the levee after dark, being in a park after dark, you name it, it goes on and on. We're supposedly liberal, but we have this whole series of restrictive anti-homeless laws that can impact immigrants, undocumented immigrants. And I'm wondering if possibly, are you getting any Spanish-speaking Latino or other immigrants who are working with you, who are not working with you because they're afraid they might be popped for these, I guess they're not so trivial in, you're facing, what, 90 days in jail if you're convicted, Ben, on your charge. You were one of the first arrested, right?
Right. Well, we do have some, support from, like, farm workers groups and so on. I mean, I think that, you know, as far as the Latino community in Florida is concerned, they have their own issues with racial profiling and immigration issues. There was a bill that failed in the legislature this year that was an attempt to create an Arizona-type law, you know, a show-me-your-papers law in Florida.
Right. But you do have this national policy, which, I mean, we're trying to create opt-out policies so that in California, counties can say, no, we're not going to turn over records to ICE, the immigration, because if someone's arrested on something trivial, not even convicted of anything, just arrested for something, that will not, you know, serve as a pretext for breaking up people's families and deporting them to the South or
right.
wherever they came from. Mostly we're talking to the South, I guess. I'm wondering if in Florida you have a similar threat and a similar process that's happening against immigrants, and also whether there's a counter move against it by activists trying to say no.
Well, there is. I'm not the best person to address those issues. I would be glad to talk to people I know who can address those issues in detail and ask and have them
sure.
It's
not
come
that
on your show.
It's not that I'm trying to do the issue independently. I'm wondering how it impacts Food Not Bombs. I mean, I didn't hear any Latino names among all those arrested so far. Do you have any people who speak Spanish who are serving food?
No, we haven't had any people who speak Spanish who are sharing food. I mean, the people with whom we share, we do have some Hispanics, but mostly a lot of them are African Americans. A lot of them are veterans, you know. And think about that: you had people who, you know, who served this country, and who, you know, who put their life on the line to fight, you know, to fight in various wars that the United States is involved in.
Well, I like to think of them as hired mercenaries and murderers, frankly. But I understand vets have a shitty row to hoe because they're promised stuff and then they're treated like shit when they get back, which is wrong.
Exactly, but
I don't want to glorify them. I don't want to talk about them as the wonderful people who protected our country. Nobody's protecting our country. We're invading lots of other countries. So let's get that straight.
Well, I'm just saying that, you know, I don't think that the promises that were made to veterans are being lived up to by the government if they're homeless and they're living on the street,
sure.
And they're not getting
sure.
the substance abuse treatment or the mental health treatment for PTSD that they need.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I interrupt you because I hate that bullshit patriotic rhetoric that, you know, it's nice to throw in to say, look how badly even vets are being treated, and then they put their lives. No. People who decide to do this stuff, although there is a poverty draft, I agree, are engaged in, you know, killing lots of innocent people abroad and also lots of people who are trying to stand up to get the U.S. out of their countries. And I don't want to glorify that at all. So when
trying to glorify it. I just was trying to point out. I was just trying to give you some ideas of the different types of people.
No, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. Forgive me for being so heated about it, but it creeps into. I mean, progressives who like to suddenly they want to start playing the flag card, and I don't want to play no flag card. Thank you very much. We don't need to play a flag card. We need to play the straight stuff because. You know, these wars are creating huge amounts of misery, and to glorify those who are in the wars, even if you think you're doing them a favor, is wrong. It is simply wrong. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, these are war criminals, and they're being forced into it to some extent, but they're also getting paid for it. So, you know, it's not a pleasant topic to talk about, and I understand what you're saying. I mean, vets need to eat, too. Everybody needs to eat.
Oh, of course.
You know, and everybody should have the right to share free food, and this is ridiculous, as we know. We're talking
the bottom line is that no matter anyone's background, we're all human beings, and I think that as such, we're all entitled to be treated with dignity and respect, and in a country, you know, as affluent as the United States, there certainly shouldn't be anyone going hungry or sleeping in bushes or
for
anything
sure.
like that.
For sure, and it seems particularly hypocritical for the government, which says, oh, men and women are defending our liberties, which they're not. They're taking away other people's liberties. But the government to claim this and then to go after the people that are supportive of them, like Food Not Bombs and other groups. So it's, you know, it's ridiculous, and it's two-faced. Of course, that's the nature of our government these days. We're talking with Ben Markson. Do I have that right, Ben?
Yes, you do, Robert.
I know I'm screwing it up every so often. Over with Orlando Food Not Bombs, he's facing a hearing, I guess, on yourself on July 5th. Well, you're going to...
No, my first court appearance is June 30th.
Now, so you're coming up. What's going to happen at that court appearance, as far as you know? What issues are at stake?
That's just an arraignment. It's just you just enter a plea, and then they set a court date. And that's it. There's not going to be any legal arguments or anything of that sort, as far as I'm aware. It's simply It's simply to enter a plea, and then the court sets a date for your trial.
And so what you do, though, is so you go to the park every Monday and Wednesday, and you just sort of stay on the sidelines, you sort of stay on the sidewalk cheering people on, or what do you do?
I stand out there holding a sign to exercise my First Amendment rights and to express my dissent from the policies of Mayor John Dyer, the policies he has that criminalize poverty. And one of the reasons I do that is because I've lived in Central Florida my entire life, and Robert, I sincerely believe that Orlando is better than this. I think Orlando is better than the mayor. I don't think the people of Orlando want people who are trying to help people in their community who are hungry. I don't think the people of Orlando want them to be stopped. And I think that the people of Orlando believe in the First Amendment, and they believe in free speech and your right to dissent from government policies. And I think that they're outraged that the Dyer administration has gone beyond the food sharing ordinance and is now trying to infringe on our First Amendment rights, because the First Amendment right is the cornerstone of any other civil liberties or rights that you have. Because without your ability to dissent and express yourself, the rest of our civil liberties really don't mean very much.
Let me be the skeptic here with all these wonderful people so outraged and defending your rights. How has this manifested itself? I mean, are people storming City Hall? Are there hundreds of emails and letters? Have you gotten thousands of dollars in legal support? I mean, let's be realistic here. I mean, I like to believe that what you're saying is true, but frankly, I wonder. So give me some solid facts and make me believe that you're not simply being hopeful rather than
I don't have statistics, but I have anecdotal evidence that suggests that the city has literally gotten hundreds, if not thousands, of emails, faxes, and phone calls, not just from Orlando, not just from Central Florida, not just from Florida, but from around the country and around the world, expressing their outrage at what's going on in Orlando. Because, I mean, I think that people, wherever they may live, people just have a hard time believing that you can actually get arrested and be threatened with a fine and jail time simply for sharing food with hungry people. And I think people find it as equally as incredulous that not only can you be arrested for that, but if you're out there trying to protest that and those policies, that you can actually have your First Amendment rights threatened.
Yeah, well, it's been true for decades, as you know, and it's, or perhaps, we probably do know. We're talking with Ben Markison of Orlando Food Not Bombs, and you have generously given us 35 minutes now, and you were going to give us only half an hour. I was going to ask only for 15 minutes, but I got carried away with this. And I'm glad you have been giving us this information. I'm glad you've given us the update on Keith McHenry, currently in jail in Orlando, Florida, charged with a crime of trespass. What? You say he was 2 or 3 inches in the city park. Is that accurate? Did he walk 2 or 3 feet in?
He was inside the city park where he was attempting to set up a literature table, and he got to the park early, and there was a plainclothes police officer there to videotape us, because we've been under police surveillance and observation for months.
Right.
They've used an amazing amount of police resources to go after an all-volunteer grassroots group mostly made up of teenagers and college students. I'm by far the oldest member. I'm like 50. And they spent an incredible amount of police resources and city resources to essentially try to stop the activities of an all-volunteer grassroots group of people who are simply trying to share food in their community with hungry people as a means of protesting poverty and inequality and other social ills. Because, see, Food Not Bombs is not a charity. We're a political group. A lot of people don't seem to understand that. We do what we do as a means of expressing our political views.
I understand.
As a matter of fact, what we do could be called expressive conduct.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And, you know, it also is, but people don't like the fact, the authorities don't like the fact that you are able to draw people in with food, because that is, since people need food, and also you present the radical idea that people can feed each other and do so without paying extravagant amounts of money and without engaging in a lot of wage slave labor and that sort of thing, which is revolutionary and goes against the very principles on which our country was founded.
Exactly. What this fight is about is this is a free speech fight, and it's also a fight about social control, because what the Dyer administration is attempting to do is it's trying to exert social control in order to, because Orlando claims it wants to be a world-class city, that it wants to make downtown Orlando like Disney World. It wants a Disney World version of a big city downtown. It doesn't want the diversity and vibrancy and the mix of people and backgrounds that you see in a real big city downtown. It wants everything to be very sanitary. It doesn't want more affluent people to be discomforted by the sight of less affluent people.
Well, Orlando is the site of Disney World, after all.
Exactly.
You know, what would Donald Duck say?
I don't know. But before I go here, may I suggest that if people want to express their opposition to Mayor John Dyer's policies of criminalizing poverty and trying to infringe on citizens' First Amendment rights, if they go to cityoforlando.net, they can find email addresses, phone numbers, and faxes for Mayor Dyer and the city commissioners for Orlando.
www.cityoforlando.net to get the email addresses for Dyer and his gang of highly paid thugs, I would call them, because it sounds like that's what they're doing. You know, I used to call the city council of Santa Cruz the Gang of Seven. And that's really, it's similar in other cities, even though there may be some people who are principled on some issues. Has the city council, anybody or on your board of supervisors, city council, spoken out against this attack on Food Not Bombs?
Well,
not
so far. When the ordinance was passed in 2006, there were two city commissioners who did vote against it. But I think that since then they've been cowed or corralled by the mayor into towing his party line, as it were.
And yet you think the majority of people in Orlando support you, even though they reelected these hacks.
Well, I think that, you know, I think that the problem is because we don't really have what you could call real democracy in Orlando. We have a faux democracy in which our political system in Orlando, just as I'm sure it is in Santa Cruz and California and other places, is dominated by moneyed special interests, by developers and business people. I think that a lot of people feel disengaged from the democratic process in Orlando because they feel like no matter who they vote for, it's someone who's bought and paid for by business interests and by corporate interests. So I think that what people are doing in this case by coming out and holding signs and emailing the mayor's office and so on is that their way of voting and expressing how they feel about this issue, because I think we've managed to engage those people. I think the injustice of the situation is really what has helped us to engage those people.
Well, I certainly hope so, and I know that I'm proud of all of you, and I want you to keep it up, particularly since I'm not having to go to jail. You are.
Well, I'm hoping not to go again. I will if I need to, but I would rather not.
Although, who knows? We may be risking arrest here if we do this June 30th, July 1st, feed-in, sleep-in at City Hall. And I'm going to ask people who've been listening to this show to call in and to talk about it. Maybe you might want to give us a minute or two to see if anybody wants to ask any questions for you, though I don't know if anybody's going to call in. I haven't had much of a call-in record recently. Do you want to wait a bit to see if anybody wants to call in, or do you got to go?
Well, unfortunately, I have another radio interview with a local station scheduled at 10:30, so I unfortunately do need to go.
All right, so that's 10:30, which, of course, is would be, 7:30 our time.
Your time, I believe.
Yeah, so you got to get to it. Listen, thanks, Ben, for calling in. For those who want more information, they should go to foodnotbombs.net?
Right, they can go to foodnotbombs.net, or they can go to OrlandoFoodNotBombs.org, and our website is in the process of being redesigned. So when they go to it, they'll see a spiffy new site with updated information.
Good, because I've seen a lot of old stuff from 2007, 2009, not too much from at least June of 2011 on your website.
Right. Well, there is a lot of good information about what's going on in Orlando and with other Food Not Bombs chapters in Florida on foodnotbombs.net, which is Keith's website, and he's going to give us his password to that so we can keep it updated while he's in jail.
Sounds good to me, and I will try to get in touch with the jail authority so we can get Keith maybe on the air again from the lockup.
Okay, awesome.
Hey, thank you, Ben.
Hey, thank you, Robert. We really appreciate your support. You've been a stalwart.
It's easy to support from behind the lines. Keep up the work on the front lines, man.
Thank you, Robert. We will.
Hey, bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was Ben Markison from Orlando Food Not Bombs. Phone lines are open to call, 427-3772, if anyone has any thoughts about this. That's a report. Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs is in jail there because, according to Ben Markison, his table was inches into the park, or he walked briefly into the park to get his table set up on the sidewalk, having been banned from the park because he was serving food there with other people and was arrested for serving food there. Now, that's in Orlando, Florida. This whole process happened in Santa Cruz and in San Francisco 20 years ago. We fought it out then, and it didn't happen, by the way. We didn't get the right to serve free food by letters to the city council or, you know, chats with the mayor. We got arrested repeatedly before we were able to clarify that they better keep our hands off us or it would be very embarrassing for them, and they finally stopped. And I'm afraid that in recent years, food services have retreated, not so much Food Not Bombs, which is kind of having problems, I think, recruiting people, because I guess folks aren't that interested in serving free food here in Santa Cruz, at least not in the last few months. But Dennis Adams, for example, who did a feeding service at the town clock and before that on Pacific Avenue, has retreated to the bushes, or I should say actually has retreated to the homeless service center, which in a way is the bushes on the edge of town. It's a very controlled, some call a concentration camp type environment. There have been a lot of complaints recently about homeless service center misconduct by officials and exclusionary activity and charging people for now currently the removal of storage units. Anyway, this is a fight that's been going. It's going on across the world, really. Of course, the austerity measures, where the bankers and the wealthy and the politicians and the developers and those with money want to maintain their system, which they do by squeezing the rest of the population, and that the rest of us have to decide if we're going to tolerate that. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norris, and you are listening to Bathrobes, Pierres, Broadsides. And thank you for listening. Again, if you want to call in, the call-in number is 831-427-3772, 427-FRSC. If you want to talk to me off-air, the number is 423-HUFF, 423-4833.
I was raised in Massachusetts on the farm where I was born. Ever since I was a young lad, to the fields I was sworn. Before our corn could go to market, it was stolen from the mill and sent to Mother England from here in the Berkshire Hills. So when I heard there'd be a rising, I put on a uniform. Slept barefoot in the mud beneath thunderstorms. In war there is no glory, just friends and comrades killed, shattered lives and broken homes here in the Berkshire Hills. In the Continental Army, the years dragged on and on. With the French, we fought the redcoats, so many people dead and gone. Ticonderoga, they surrendered, we had won this test of wills, and those of us left alive came back here to the Berkshire Hills. Then began the nightmare all over once again. Revolutions, debtors' prisons filled with good upstanding men. We said to hell with King John Adams. Of this farce we'd had our fill, and we set our sights on liberty here in the Berkshire Hills. Couldn't function, their judges on the run. Each new day we had our farms was a victory we'd won. For years we kept our land, held our ground until we made our last stand by Great Barrington here in the Berkshire Hills. My name is Danielle Shays, and I'm speaking to you now. If I fought a revolution, maybe you can tell me how. I was born a poor man, and I'm a poor man still. Bury me beneath the hemlock here in the Berkshire Hills.
And that was a number from David Rovick's Troubadour, People's History and Song, and it was called Shay's Rebellion. Actually, it was called Berkshire Hills. And here's what Rovix writes about that. If you were hiking on the Appalachian Trail in western Massachusetts to the edge of a cornfield, you will come upon a small monument to the last battle fought on the rebellion of the farmers of the region, known as Shay's Rebellion. Having spent some years fighting against the British in the cause of liberty and democracy, the farmers of western Massachusetts quickly discovered that the same old landlords were still running and actually charging farmers back rent for the time they were away fighting. They couldn't pay, and the veterans of the revolution were losing their farms to the greedy landlords. Betrayed and destitute, farmers organized. One of the highest-ranking officers of the Continental Army, among them Daniel Shays, was elected leader of the rebel army and commenced a campaign of terror against the landlords and their courts, through which evictions were taking place. Although there was widespread sympathy for the rebels, including among the militias, the state employed... It's hard to read this. Some of it is difficult to read. But that's some of what Shay's Rebellion is about. If you go online to Wikipedia, you find more. Shays was a poor farmman from Massachusetts when the revolution broke out, joined the Continental Army when he fought at the Battle of Lexington, Bunker Hill, Saratoga, eventually wounded in action. In 1780, he resigned from the Army unpaid and went home to find himself in court for non-payment of debts. He soon found that he was not alone in being unable to pay his debts, and once even saw a sick woman who had her bed taken out from under her because she was unable to pay. Opening salvos in central Massachusetts in the town of Uxbridge in Worcester County, February 3, 1783, was Shay's Rebellion. Governor John Hancock, you know, that's one of those American governors after they threw out the British, supposedly, suppressed local riots after a request by Colonel Nathan Tyler. And Shay's Rebellion caused George Washington to emerge from retirement to advocate a stronger national government. Financial situation leading to the rebellion included the problem that the European war investors, among others, demanded payment in gold and silver. There was not enough specie in the states, including Massachusetts, that's paper money, to pay the debts. And through the state, wealthy urban businessmen were trying to squeeze whatever assets they could get out of rural smallholders. Since the smallholders did not have the gold that the creditors demanded, everything they had was confiscated, including their houses. at a meeting convened by aggrieved commoners, a farmer, Plow Jogger, encapsulated the situation. Quote, I've been greatly abused, I've been obliged to do more than my part in the war, been loaded with class rates, town rates, province rates, he means taxes, I suppose, continental rates, and all rates, have been pulled and hauled by sheriffs, constables, and collectors, had my cattle sold for less than they were worth. The great men are going to get all we have, and I think it's time for us to rise and put a stop to it, and have no more courts, nor sheriffs, nor collectors, nor lawyers. It was decided that the legislature in Boston would be petitioned. Veterans of the Continental Army, like General Charles Logan Harding, aggrieved because they had been conscripted, had to fight with no payment to help them pay for their living, and because they were treated poorly upon discharge, including being locked up in debtor's prison, began to organize their neighbors, the besieged farmers, into squads and companies in order to halt the confiscations. Veteran Luke Day of West Spring, Massachusetts, asked the judges holding the confiscatory hearings to adjourn until the Massachusetts legislature met. Throughout Massachusetts, newly organized farmers and veterans faced militia at courthouse thresholds, but sometimes the farmers and veterans were the militia, and often the majority of the militia sided with the veterans and farmers. What caused Shays to take on the situation as a revolutionary cause was that on September 19th, the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts indicted 11 leaders of the rebellion as disorderly, riotous, and seditious persons. Incensed by the indictment, Shays organized 700 armed farmers, most of them war veterans, and led them to Springfield. As they marched, their ranks grew, and some of the militia joined them, along with additional reinforcements from the countryside. Boston elites were mortified at this resistance. The judges first postponed hearings for a day, then adjourned the court. Massachusetts Governor James Baudouin commanded the legislature to vindicate the insulted dignity of government. Samuel Adams claimed that foreigners, British emissaries, were instigating treason among commoners, and he helped draw up a riot act and a resolution suspending habeas corpus in order to permit the authorities to keep people in jail without trial. Sound familiar? Adams proposed a new legal distinction that rebellion in a republic, unlike in a monarchy, should be punished by execution. The legislatures also moved to make some concessions to the upstart farmers, saying certain old taxes could now be paid in goods instead of money. However, this only led to increasing confrontations between farmers and militia. George Gale, in the Gale Family Records, wrote the following in 1866. As early as 1771, the records of the town of Princeton, Massachusetts, show that Captain Henry Gale, a co-leader of the Shays Rebellion, had in that town a good farm valued at £185, with three buildings and a good stock of cattle. And in 1778, Henry removed to that town where he resided until he moved to Bear, Vermont, in about 1790. In Princeton, he lived in comparative independence. I'm going to skip some of this. The point was that that was a song celebrating Shays' Rebellion, so I'm going to leave it at that and now get back to the conclusion of the interview I was doing with Keith McHenry a week ago. This is Keith McHenry, who is currently in jail in Orlando, Florida, for setting up a political table 2 inches into the park, or a few inches into the park, from which he had been banned by the judge because previously he had been serving free food there. Yes, Alice in Wonderland isn't just a story. It apparently seems to be existing condition in Orlando, Florida.
Canada is doing stuff to gut its health care program to make it more like an American-type program. There's kind of a Canadian version of the Tea Party that the mayor of Toronto is privatizing, many of the municipal services. He just is doing away with bike lanes and so on like that within the city. So this, corporate assault on the people of the world is advancing on one level, and at the same time, the pushback is starting, which is really fantastic. Well, I hope America rises up this summer. I think this could be the start of something, and I really encourage people to do the July 1st action on Friday, July 1st. I know that you have particularly greater problems with the possibility of arrest there because of the ongoing struggle. But it's certainly if possibly by uniting it with other vigils around the country, it will provide more strength to what you're doing locally as well. So you can point to other cities doing the same thing.
Yeah, in Santa Cruz, it's become illegal to have a hold up a picket sign or to walk actually onto the property of the city hall, which is supposed to be public property, after 10 o'clock at night, because that was a measure adopted to disperse the small band of protesters from Peace Camp 2010 last year, who continued to protest against Santa Cruz's anti-homeless sleeping ban. There's a coverage in the paper recently of massive protests in Greece and a possible financial tumult going on there. Any word from Food Not Bombs there? By the way, there is no Food Not Bombs in Santa Cruz. Whoever told you that is telling you stories. I've been looking around, and people who were...
Well, that's too bad, because, these people have been eagerly emailing me about their Food Not Bombs chapter.
Well, tell them to whip out the fruit and vegetables, and we'll see what they can do. But anything from... is there a Greece and Athens Food Not Bombs? Any word from them?
I don't know if we have an Athens. We did have one at one point. I haven't heard from them in a while. But it certainly is pretty impressive, the whole thing that's happening there today. It looks like the government is collapsing, and in many financial circles they're saying if Greece can't, it's just incredible. It's like a huge section of the population is out there on the streets, and it's much more massive protests than I've been before. And the several cabinet members resigned. It looks like the government's collapsing, and the rest of the economic world is freaking out that there's now going to be this huge bailout there. And it does look like the other countries, like Spain and Italy and Portugal, are in trouble. Ireland. And I think that it's pretty likely through this summer and into the fall, with all that is going on, that we are going to start to, the capitalist media may start to admit that things aren't going so well. And it'll become clear that this isn't just like random people that are falling through the cracks, that this is actually a total system meltdown. And it's already some, some economists are saying that statistically things are really even more crazy. Like, people have been out longer, out of work longer, like a higher percentage out longer than of work than at times of the Great Depression, things like that. It's quite amazing.
We're talking about
now that's the context of the arrests in Orlando are under this, in this context. There's you have a global economy that is in crisis, and then at the same time you're criminalizing the victims of the crisis. And I was called 2 days ago. Houston Food Not Bombs called me to say that their city is announcing that they're going to try to drive that chapter out of sight. So we know that Fort Myers recently was harassed by the city and told that they had to stop sharing food in Fort Myers, Florida. So you have this increasing assault against the people who are unable to find work, and they're now seeking housing and seeking employment, seeking food. And so that's the response, rather than, at all costs protect the super rich and wage war against the people that have been victimized by this political and economic system.
I've been talking with Keith McHenry, co-founder of Food Not Bombs, currently apparently avoiding Lake Eola Park, where how many people have been arrested now for sharing free food over the last 2 weeks?
It's been 21 people arrested so far. I mean, I go down to every meal, and I do my literature table, and I hang out.
It's now 24 if you include Keith, arrested for the additional crime of violating a no trespass order.
People, and I actually kind of help coordinate what's happening with the other people, making sure the tables are in the right place, because new people keep coming. We had probably about 30, 40 new Food Not Bombs activists from other cities show up on Wednesday. It was quite impressive.
And the next meal is on Monday?
Yeah, the next meal will be breakfast on Monday. And we're putting up on the web, we're going to have, if you go to foodandbombs.net, we're going to have photos of yesterday's arrest later this evening. And we will also have photos of the alternative location the mayor is suggesting, which is a fenced-in area under a freeway with a barbed wire fence on the barbed wire on top of the chain link fence, and other details. We'll also be providing answers to what the mayor is saying. We have a petition, two petitions actually. One that's put out by change.org. And that's getting quite a lot of signatures. We need more signatures on that. And we also have another one that was put out by homeless advocates in Japan just a couple of days after the initial arrest. That just reached like about 1,200. And we need lots more people signing these petitions. And we need people organizing for the July 1st tent city vigils at city halls. And any groups that can write statements of support and send a copy to both us and to the mayor, Buddy Dyer, would be fantastic. I mean, this is something that we need to build momentum. It's very hard in a city, southern city like Orlando. While there's a lot of, you know, everybody, like the people that were jailed yesterday all expressed how surprised they were at the support they had from the officers, the police, and how that they were just shocked that they were being ordered to do this. And, of course, the inmates and jailers were completely upset. So he's pretty isolated as long as we can build popular support. And we've also urged people to call Democracy Now! And write letters to The Nation magazine, other media, progressive media outlets, because we really need to get into some of the larger media venues about this issue, because if people knew about it, I think we would have a big impact. And it's super important because we've got to stop this from becoming the policy of the United States, where every city limits people from its free speech rights and every city limits people's right to share food.
Keith, thank you for taking time out to give us the update. For those who want to, of course, go to foodnotbombs.net. That's a place to get more information about the Orlando scene and to access the photos, access links, access, I guess, addresses for Mayor Buddy Dyer and other Food Not Bombs in other cities that are having problems in Houston. Am I right?
Yep, that's exactly where to go. And then also they can call toll-free at the Hunger Hotline, which is 1-800-884-1136. And I will do what I can to rouse these Santa Cruz Food Not Bombs activists. I don't know why they were writing me all this information if they're not actually trying to do Food Not Bombs. That just seems kind of sad.
Well, I don't actually know who you're talking about. Maybe if you forward me the emails, I can encourage, you know, try to get in touch with them. They, Food Not Bombs activists in Santa Cruz, are formerly operating out of the Chavez Collective, but they aren't anymore, and nobody's seen them around town that I've heard. So we'll see if they show up at the Sub Rosa Cafe or other places where they used to show up. But so far, it's a barren situation.
Okay, well, we'll try to mobilize that again. I mean, it's great. This morning I just found out we have a new Tampa Food Not Bombs, and they had a rough go of it. They actually had four people jailed about maybe 8-10 years ago, and they were sentenced to half a year in prison or jail for that. I don't know how long they actually did.
Where was this?
That was Tampa, Florida. And then another brave group of people came back out and got arrested again. Several years later, and they actually overturned the initial anti-sharing law in that city, so that was quite impressive. So hopefully this stuff will, the new chapter starting up because of the arrest in Orlando is quite impressive.
Well, keep up the feeding there, and, leave a carrot available for me if I show up, which, of course, I won't.
Okay, we certainly will. Well, thank you so much, and send everybody to Orlando.
Hey, I will.
Take care.
Thank you, man. Bye-bye.
And that was Keith McHenry before he went to jail about a week ago. And who knows, maybe we'll be able to get an interview with him in jail. Phone number here, in case you want to call in and comment on any of this, is 427-3772, 427-FRSC. Tomorrow, of course, is a hearing for attorney and activist Ed Fry at 8:30 in the morning in Department 2, for those who are interested. And there'll be a protest, as there has been every morning, I'm told, in front of the courthouse from 7:30 to 9, or perhaps till 8:30 in this case. Folks might want to check that out. You'll be able to talk with some HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom activists, see what can be done locally to maybe organize something around the proposed Solidarity Day with Food Not Bombs in Orlando and across the globe with people of the world who are facing cutbacks in the social service net, police repression, and so forth. That's tomorrow morning, starting at 7:30, protest at the county building at 8:30 at Department 2, a hearing for Ed Fry and perhaps for Gary Johnson. I'm not sure if he has a hearing or not. I'm told he does, but I haven't had that confirmed. These are two men who are currently serving six-month jail terms in the county jail. Well, I guess Gary's in the county jail, and Ed is on the in the Watsonville facility for the crime of peaceful protest in front of the county building, which the authorities call lodging, and which the judge explained to the jury was sleeping in a city that has no legal place for homeless to sleep at night, at least for the overwhelming majority of homeless people, and certainly had zero beds last. Possibly two beds were available last summer. That was, I think, some of the testimony that came up in court to prove that there was no necessity for people to, for the 40 to 50 people to sleep outside the courthouse of the city's 1,500 to 2,000 homeless people, because there were, after all, two beds available at the River Street Shelter. Interesting claim by the DA, very disingenuous, and it's a sad situation that's happening, but people hopefully are seeing more of it. Maybe people's sense of injustice is being stirred. Certainly that it should be, I think, and it's something that you might want to check out tomorrow morning at 8:30 in Department 2. So, I have some more interviews coming up, which I may actually get a chance to play, at least some of them, in the next 35 minutes. I did also read an email from Bob Patton, who is a former homeless activist, as well as a spokesman for veterans groups. And he wrote the following. If I can keep my computer from getting away from me, I will read to you. Dear veterans and friends, as most of you know, over the last month, the veterans have been working with the supervisors to allow an agenda item to be placed on an upcoming scheduled supervisor meeting. This in light of new and current engineers' reports and a letter from the State Historic Building Review Board that confirms an earlier engineer's claim that the closure of the Veterans Memorial Building and eviction of the veterans was not, repeat, not necessary or mandated under any current building code. At the June 14th supervisors meeting, the veterans organized a presentation to the board on these issues. We are asking for a review of the necessity of the closure where experts and veterans can present and discuss in public this closure. It seems we've gotten a friendly ear from Supervisor Greg Caput, or is it Caput? I'm not sure. He agrees to place the request in front of the supervisors at the next meeting, June 28th, that's next Tuesday, starting at 9 a.m. in room 550 of the county building, 701 Ocean Street. If you've not already informed your supervisor of your opinions, please do so. The request will need a second from another supervisor. Encourage them to support Greg's motion to place this on an upcoming session in August. There are no supervisor meetings in July. Feel free to distribute the request widely to both veterans and supporters. If you do not know who your supervisor is, contact their main phone number at 454-2200, 454-2200. Unfortunately, the supervisors do not have a 24-hour message line. You have to call them during business hours on a weekday. And that's the word from Bob Patton. Again, it seems that the vets are politely petitioning the government, but I guess that's what the vets of the Revolutionary War did before Shay's Rebellion, and I guess those vets were losing their farms and their homes, not just their meeting place, the Vets Memorial Hall, although I think that's a serious seizure of a community asset, particularly an asset for the vets, which shouldn't have been tolerated and shouldn't be tolerated now. And again, I'm a person who generally talks about direct actions, which I think would have much more effect and impact on the community instead of just watching everything go down the tube while the supervisors talk about it and the courts talk about doing something about it or don't talk about doing something about it. But I'm talking. I'm not acting. So I'm doing something similar. So, hey, watch out for me. Here's some more interviews from earlier days. Actually, before I do that, let me take a brief musical break because I want to make sure I've got the right tape queued up. Again, you can call in if you have any thoughts on any of this, 427-3772, area code 831.
My name is John Riley. I'll have your ear only a while. I left my dear home in Ireland. It was death, starvation, or exile. When I got to America, it was my duty to go enter the army and slog across Texas to join in the war against Mexico. And it was there in the pueblos and hillsides that I saw the mistake I had made. Part of a conquering army with the morals of a bayonet blade. And there amidst all these poor dying Catholics, screaming children, the burning stench of it all, myself and 200 Irishmen decided to rise to the call. From Dublin City to San Diego, we witnessed freedom denied. So we formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. We formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side.
We got about at least a quarter of a battalion right here, so you can sing along with it.
We marched with the green flag of St. Patrick, emblazed with Erin Goldbrow. Right with the harp and the shamrock and Libertad Pura Republica. Just 50 years after Wolf Tone, 5,000 miles away, the Yanks called us a legion of strangers, and they can talk as they may. But from Dublin City to San Diego, we witnessed freedom denied. So we formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side.
What'd we do?
We formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. We fought them in Matamoros, where their volunteers were raping the nuns. In Monterrey and Cerro Gordo, we fought on as Ireland's sons. We were the red-headed fighters for freedom amidst these brown-skinned women and men. Side by side we fought against tyranny, and I dare say we'd do it again. From Dublin City to San Diego, we witnessed freedom denied. So we formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. We formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. Churubusco was the last. Overwhelmed by the cannons from Boston, we fell after each mortar blast. Most of us died on that hillside at the service of the Mexican state. So far from our occupied homeland, we were heroes and victims of fate. From Dublin City to San Diego, we witnessed freedom denied. So we formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. From Dublin City to San Diego, we witnessed freedom denied. So we formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. We formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side.
And that was another one by David Robicks, the St. Patrick Battalion, about the San Patricios of 1846. And there's a little bit of commentary in his linear notes. The shocking fact that the population of Ireland has still not come close to reaching the 8 million people who called the island home at the time of the British conquest. Still today, the scars of centuries of slavery, torture, and deprivation imposed on the people of Ireland by the British conquerors are evident to any astute observer. Millions of Irish people, writes Robicks, were killed by the invading armies from across the Irish Sea, and millions more left the island to escape persecution and death. The United States was the destination of choice. In 1846, the U.S. launched a war of aggression, one of many such wars the would-be rulers of the Americas would initiate over the course of centuries of empire building, and arguably the most successful among them. By 1849, Mexico had lost most of its territory to their invading neighbor, never to regain it. The 1840s was a time of upheaval, not just in Ireland, but across Europe, and the U.S. at that time saw an unprecedented wave of immigration. The new immigrants were put to use right away. They were handed a gun and a uniform and told to prove their loyalty to their newfound nation by killing Mexicans. It is often said that people mainly do things out of self-interest. Yet history demonstrates time and again that on so many occasions, people are willing to suffer terrible hardship and even risk or lose their lives in the defense of people other than themselves. As the U.S. Army killed, raped, and burned their way deeper into Mexico, thousands of soldiers deserted. The mainly Irish group of soldiers who came to be known as the San Patricio could have done the same, and as many did, could have lived out their natural lives without being caught. But these 202 deserters took things a step further. They joined the Mexican army. With their own green flags and uniforms, the San Patricios engaged the U.S. Army in five major battles. And most of them, again, this is difficult to read. Most of those who were captured after the last of the five battles were hanged for treason. Those that managed to escape lived out their lives in Mexico, marrying and having families. And some places in Mexico are said to have a greater number of red-haired residents as a result today. If you visit the beautiful San Jalisco neighborhood of Mexico City, you will find a small plaque dedicated to the memory of the San Patricios on one of the walls of the Catholic Church, in which many of the men lived when they made it to the capital city. That's a song by David Robicks, Troubadour, about another group of people who fought imperialism, U.S. imperialism, actually. Now let's do some jump back to some street interviews. And oh yes, a quick announcement before I go any further. This surprised me, and I don't want to say it encouraged me, because I'm not sure why I don't want to say it encouraged me, but it certainly surprised me, and it's public information. I should let you know about it. The U.S. Conference of Mayors last Friday proposed a resolution urging faster withdrawal from the imperialist wars. I don't think they used the word imperialist, though, in that discussion. And I've actually sent out emails on the Huff email list specifying that. And there was a little segment on Amy Goodman today interviewing Mayor Kitty Piercy of Eugene, Oregon, who led the resolution, which apparently was supported by 1,200 communities in this country, according to Piercy, which asked, which was a the first statement from the U.S. Conference on Mayors in 30 or 40 years on foreign wars. They had a much stronger statement, I think, back in the 70s on getting out of Vietnam. But this one was still a statement of dissatisfaction with the war in the sense that local priorities were being ignored, and urging the government to start reapportioning money, sort of, well, food, not bombs-wise. Originally, the resolution was going to be introduced, and that faction which wanted it, headed by Mayor Villaraigosa of Los Angeles, he backed off as the lead sponsor, but he ended up supporting it because it was passed by the U.S. Conference, and he's the head of the Conference of Mayors. I sent an email to our mayor, Ryan Coonerty, who advised me he was not a member. Santa Cruz is not a member of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and he wasn't, the city wasn't, and he wasn't as mayor. But he said he would send a letter supporting it, and I sent him a letter back thanking him for that. And I spent some time in my discussions on the air urging the city to disinvest itself from war profiteering, such as the organization Camp Dresser and McKee, which apparently it hired as a desal consultant. I've asked them to look into other investments that may be involved in corporations that profiteer from the Iraqi and Afghanistan wars. And they've gotten some lip service from, ironically, the man I'm suing in court, former Mayor Fitzmaurice. Nobody has ever done anything, as far as I know, in any public way around that issue. And there have been no resolutions urging us to get out of Libya, to stop supporting the Iraqi and Afghanistan wars. And Coonerty is still not pushing for such a resolution. But he did say he would write a letter supporting this as mayor of Santa Cruz. And again, I'll publicly thank him for doing that, and invite him to come on the air and discuss this issue and other issues further, as I have for the last half year, and so far he's declined to do that. I hope he'll change his mind, though I don't necessarily expect he will. Thank you, Ryan, for at least emailing me that you're about to send out a letter supporting the U.S. Conference of Mayors position. And that specific resolution, I can find it here, and I think I wrote it down. Let's see if I can find the thing. It may not be so easy to do. It looks like it's not here. I think it actually is. So give me a moment and I'll try to find it. While I'm doing that, let me play a little from a Sunday or two ago. I think it was Sunday before last. Ronnie Curry had some announcements. She gives food out every Sunday in front of the former Borders store downtown on Pacific Avenue at a new time. I think it's 12 to 1:30 is now their approximate time.
Oh, it is around 2:20 on June 12th, Sunday afternoon, beautiful Sunday afternoon on Pacific Avenue. And Ronnie and Scott are just taking off in their vehicle after having done their meal, fed about 60 people. And it's been they have a new feeding time. When's that new feeding time?
12:30 on Sundays.
And it goes until?
Whenever. We try not to run people out too quick. Want them to be comfortable.
I'll double bag it too.
Here, here. And Renee, you have some news about new donors who have been donating money to the program?
Well, it's not new donors. I talk about what we do, which is sort of an outreach to the homeless community on my Facebook page, and I have a nonprofit link. But with the economy the way it is, we're really short on donations, and a lot of the socks and things we try to keep on a regular basis, we've been paying for out of our own pocket. So I just think it's really cool that several of our homeless friends have stepped up to can contribute. One contributed $100, and one contributed a bunch of food to our food, our lunch on the Avenue outreach today. And then you contributed because you love us so much.
Because of my deep religious faith in the Holy Bible. Just kidding, folks. I like people who take certain parts of the Bible seriously. Also, I dislike certain people who take other parts of the Bible seriously. But that's another story.
I'm nodding my head and smiling in... I'm not going into that conversation mode.
Fair enough. She's smiling, though. Look at that. Anyway, anything else happened in the last week or two that the community should know about? Renanding coming up?
How
much outreach to Spanish-speaking folks?
I know
you have no translator when you do your Bible study. Why don't you get somebody who can speak Spanish, you bigot, you?
I know, huh? That's interesting, because actually when I teach in jail, I get Spanish students that don't understand a word I'm saying. I have no idea why they sit there for an hour and a half, but they do, so.
Anything to get out of the cell.
Yeah? Well, I don't know. They have us in a room that is about the size of a cell, smaller than their cells.
Well, it's a chance to do something different than hang out with the same crowd.
That's right. Something different, yeah. But they might actually like my Bible study, Robert.
Possibly. They may be able to see beneath the thin veneer of language.
Or maybe it's an angelic language and they're just understanding it. I don't know.
I have a psychiatrist you could talk to if you'd like. I know. They're very understanding.
Second chapter of Acts, so that fits right in with my... That was a segue.
There you go. Thank you. We've been talking with...
Ronay Curry. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you. See you at 12:30 next... I guess I won't be there, but others will, because I have my show at 12:30. My show goes till 1.
Oh.
But I'll pass on the word.
Yeah. And come out at 1 and talk to us, and I'll say stuff into your little handy-dandy tape recorder. You know what? You really need an iPhone.
Hey, donations are always accepted. Thank you, Renee. We're talking with the vivacious and attractive...
Ilana.
And Ilana, you heard a nice round table with a red kind of softy cloth on it.
Yeah.
And you have various bits of jewelry displayed. Are these of your own making?
All of them are.
And what's the average time it takes to make you one of these pieces?
Depending on the piece, it could take me 20 minutes, it could take me 2 hours, it could take me 2 days.
And let's give me an example. Let's see, which piece has made the longest, taken you the longest time, and which was the quickest to make?
This was the longest one to make.
And describe it for us.
It is a necklace made with soda-like moonstone, a little bit of pearl, and seed beads and wire-wrapped glass.
How many hours would you estimate you put into that?
It probably took me,
Huh?
3 to 4 hours. And that's because I was working with a very poor selection of moonstone. The shapes were very awkward, and I had to match them exactly in pairs.
Do you do this work alone, or do you have someone who helps you?
I do most of this alone, but sometimes my little brother helps me.
And how old are you?
I'm 22.
And your little brother is?
18.
So he's not as little as some.
Not that little. He's bigger than me, but he's always going to be my little brother.
Now, are you housed or homeless?
I'm in between things at the moment.
Family disruption, economic problems, physical, philosophical, religious quest?
Well, my uncle was very, very sick, and he's dying. And he went back home overseas to go and die in his house, and he decided to just leave me and my brother here. So we had to... work really fast and really hard, too.
You were previously supported by your uncle?
I was his caretaker while I went to school, and then he abandoned me right before I graduated, and...
He abandoned you, or he got real sick?
Well...
Both,
exactly. He just woke up one day in the middle of semester before graduation and said that he was going to go back home in a week and that we had to go.
And so is this how you support yourself, with this kind of work?
I do this. I do odd jobs. I have a part-time job, but, you know, it's not really enough to survive.
What about your brother?
My brother, he just got a job the other week, and before then, I mean, he was doing things that probably were not legal that I don't ask about to make money.
We'll get into that in a moment. As soon as I call this officer over, just a moment, though. I'm talking. So, Renee, you come over because you actually lent. What's your name again?
Alana,
the table to show her jewelry, but you apparently there was some other intervention that police had that you were able to fend off.
No, what it was is Alana was on the corner we normally serve on, and one of my volunteers had gone over and asked her to move, which I don't ever do. I don't ask people that are already there to move, and so I felt bad, and so we offered Alana lunch and our table, but the cops had just come and said just before I offered her that she couldn't do her display on the ground. So it just that's how it worked out.
Huh. Yeah. And so, but Alana, was there another person who was asked?
And before we go on to hear more about the police going after Alana, the jeweler, the jewelry person. It's an interesting question as to whether it's illegal to put your stuff on the ground. It's not, as far as I know, there's no ordinance that does deal with that. There is an ordinance that says you have to move along a display device every hour, which is their attempt to cut short protests, move along panhandlers, make it a less than a friendly environment for people who are out there because they can't be at one spot for any more than an hour. If they have a display device. But whether this also applies to the sidewalk itself has never been clearly determined. And in fact, on occasion, when the police were insisting we move a display device, we simply moved everything onto the sidewalk and said, this is the new area where we're going to be. We don't have a display device. Get lost. I mean, we're legal, so let us be. And I don't think we were hassled for that. Of course, that was 8 years ago. And last I remember that was done, at least the particular incident I'm thinking of. Anyway, back to this incident, which we're listening to a tape from June 12th, I believe. Or thereabouts.
Well, that you noticed. We're switching to slow speed.
There were a couple who had been vending a long time. You said they've got ticketed, and I saw the cops up and down the street. I was watching them harass the street musicians and the people sitting on the ground. I was sitting there for 10 minutes watching them talk to every single person that they didn't like.
And how many people did they talk to that you counted?
I think they talked to 5 or 6 people that I could see in the time I'd been sitting here already. It was really weird.
And hey, you guys. And what was the response of the people? Did they move? Did they stay there? Did they get ticketed?
They moved. They all moved.
Go ahead.
I wish I could remember her name because they had come over last week and eaten lunch with us. But she was yelling, leaving, walking across the street right when we got here. And I didn't know what was going on. But it was the cops then, yeah. Because I did see cops. I don't pay attention. I don't pay a lot of attention. For some reason, they don't bother me, and so I sort of keep my blinders on. But I think Alana's right. I think they ticketed them, and that must have been what she was yelling about.
What were they doing when they were ticketed? Did you notice? What was the?
I didn't notice it because I think I'd just gotten.
They sell sort. It's like it's a macrame hemp. Rope jewelry.
Did you see who the cops were? Was it Officers Winston and Forbes? Was it somebody else?
It was the same cops that were...
Winston and what?
Winston is a kind of a short, peppery fellow. Forbes is a somewhat chunkier guy.
Oh, Forbes? Yeah. Okay, because I think that guy's the one who bothered me.
What exactly did he tell you that was upsetting?
I felt really threatened by him because of the way he was talking down to me, like I wasn't human or something. I'm like, well, what kind of crime am I doing here exactly? I'm not bothering anybody. I'm not harassing anybody. I'm not yelling at anybody. And he was very, very angry. And he was saying, well, you can't move this. You have to be on the other side of this. Are you new here? And it was just like he was talking to me like I'm some stupid child that, you know, like I'm unintelligent, like I'm not a person.
You're a civilian. He's a cop. Shape up.
Exactly. I mean, I hear people, when I was here last time, I heard some homeless person was talking to me asking about how the cops had treated me and how he'd done a similar thing and that you're supposed to make up excuses about how you have some kind of charity. And he gave the best response ever that I said. He's like, well, you know, if I don't make this, how am I supposed to make my donation so you cops can get your donuts? And it made me laugh.
Indeed. I don't know if that would have pleased officers involved. You actually have a right to display your artwork. Now, the problem, this isn't sort of a gray zone as far as the city attorney goes, as far as I know. If you were doing your painting, they couldn't bother you. If you were doing your writing, they couldn't bother you.
Oh.
But if you're doing crafts, it's a question of whether they, you know, it. You can actually put prices on your stuff if you have your own artwork, and it's artwork but not necessarily crafts. Did they tell you not to put prices out, or did any problem like that?
They told me that I wasn't allowed to ask for a price. They said I could ask for a donation, and I couldn't say what that was.
I don't think that's true either. You have the right to engage in free speech activities. Was all this kind of told to you by, was an officer alone, or were there several officers there?
There were two.
And you said they seemed to be going up and down the avenue doing this?
Yes, they were harassing everybody that I could see. Whether they were sitting down or playing on an instrument, I could see the cops talking to lots of people.
And how long have you been doing this?
Well, my life became very interesting the past year, and I've been doing this whenever I've, you know, been able to get out here or to other cities for the past, I want to say, 6 months.
By interesting, do you mean economically difficult?
Yes.
Or you mean that in addition to economically difficult?
It's both. Difficult financially with family and living situations, with jobs. It's been very interesting.
Are you outside? Do you sleep out?
No, I have friends who take care of me.
So you do have friends to take care of you. And is that something that you think is going to be going on for the next few months, or are you on a limited chain here?
I have people who love me very much, and they take care of me, and so I don't think that I'm going to end up outside, you know.
Sounds good to me. Anything you want to say to folks out there about what you've seen in Santa Cruz through your new experiences out here on the avenue?
Well, some of the nicest people I've ever met here were the homeless people. They were absolutely wonderful. I've had them offer me oranges and little trinkets and beads, and just people are so sweet to me here, giving me advice. And so I just, you know, don't judge people just because, you know, they look different or something.
I imagine some have been pretty grouchy to you as well.
I haven't had anyone be grouchy to me yet.
What about these police officers?
Well, just the police officers, but, you know, not.
You pay them to do that. You see, that's part of their job. They enjoy. You get. Well, I won't even go into that. That seems kind of strange that the only grouches are the paid grouches downtown.
Yeah, the hospitality people to me have been nice. The cops have always been evil, but everybody else has been nice to me.
Sounds good. We've been talking with
Alana.
Thanks, Alana. We're talking with that. And that's about all the people we've got time to talk to tonight, although I'm going to read briefly from an article in the San Francisco Chronicle in the B section. The B section always has most of the real interesting news. It's the second section of the paper. This is about the murder of Oscar Grant, who was mortally wounded by a BART police officer who got the lightest sentence in history for a murder that I've ever heard of, and he was released recently. An Oakland Fire Department employee...
Amazingly, he's still alive.
Not amazingly. The police officers protect their own, and so do the courts, and so does the society generally, unfortunately. An Oakland Fire Department employee embroiled in a long dispute with the agency has filed a lawsuit claiming that his colleagues provided inadequate treatment to Oscar Grant after he was fatally shot by a BART police officer. Sean Gillis, who works in the training division at the fire department's Emergency Medical Services Division, filed the whistleblower suit Friday in Alameda County Superior Court. He says his superiors engage in racism, sexism, and cronyism. Among the claims Gillis makes in the 150-page complaint, which names the department as well as the supervisor, EMS Chief William Sugiyama, are that Gillis was demoted and harassed after he began investigating Grant's death, which was January 1, 2009. Grant had been shot at point-blank range, the lawsuit says. The bullet created an entry and exit wound. The paramedic applied an airproof bandage only to the entry wound and left the exit wound exposed to the air. Grant died from his wounds 5.5 hours later. Interim Fire Chief Mark Hoffman said in an interview Wednesday that he had investigated the allegations by Gillis, who was not at the scene of Grant's shooting at Bart's Fruitvale Station, and found them to be untrue. The claims about Oscar Grant are preposterous. They really are, Hoffman said. The pathologist who examined Grant's body, Dr. Thomas Rogers, has testified that the 22-year-old Hayward resident could not have survived his internal injuries. He also said the bullet had not exited Grant because he was shot in the back with his chest pressed against the cement. The bullet ricocheted and remained inside his body, according to trial testimony. The former Bart police officer who shot Grant, Johannes Merzeli, was released June 13th after serving half of a two-year sentence for involuntary manslaughter. He testified at the trial that he had accidentally shot Grant while intending to subdue him with a taser shock weapon. That's it for Bathrop's Pier's Broadsides tonight. And we have one of my fans here, of course. Dennis is always welcome in the studio, at least because I don't bother to lock him out. It would be embarrassing. I'll be back perhaps on Sunday at 9:30. That's when I usually come in, maybe next week. Who knows? There doesn't seem to be too much call for the show because I'm not getting too many call-ins. So if you want the show to continue, give a call to 423-HUFF and let me know that you're still listening. Otherwise, well, there may be more fertile fields to plow, so to speak. In any case, it was good putting out this information, and consider coming to a protest and helping to organize one on June 30th at the City Hall in support of Orlando Food Not Bombs and, I don't know, people throughout the world threatened with the austerity cuts. Thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathrop's Pier's Broadsides. Again, the call-in number off-air if you want to get in touch is 423-HUFF, 423-4833.
Time, sweet time, precious time.